KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. We look at the films from, let's go back to Mouse Hunt, to The Ring, to Pirates of the Caribbean, to his newest film, A Cure for Wellness, perhaps the most provocative title of the 21st century. You can see in Gore Verbinski's films, I think, a propensity towards marrying surrealism shot in the most beautiful hyper-realistic style, which creates a visual contrast and makes the films so compelling. We're here to talk to Gore about his new film, A Cure for Wellness. First of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Elvis. Nice to be here.
Oh, my pleasure. And that idea of these juxtapositions, a visual juxtaposition, that idea of taking absurdist situations, really, and shooting them in a hyper-realistic style, where does that come from for you?
I don't know. I think we live in this kind of increasingly irrational world, and it affects, you know, it sort of makes its way into the language, just like, you know, literature and movies and imagery and sound and music. I think it's all there. But it's something, I feel like we're on the verge of something very Dada right now, you just are in our real life.
But I feel like that goes back to you. I mean, I'm thinking about NoFX videos and Bad Religion. It worked that way from the very beginning, that eye was always there for piling on as much visual detail as you can.
Well, it's a language. I mean, it's, you know, construction of shots is a language, just like wordsmithing.
And I was saying to you before we sat down that I saw the movie, the first thing that hit me was Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain.
Yeah.
And just that idea, and there's so many filmmakers who've gone there. I can think from Alan Parker with the wall, to going back to Sam Fuller and Shock Carter, the idea that those tile surfaces are so terrifying.
Yeah, and there's something nice about something as benign and tranquil as a wellness center to be the place of sort of, you know, the louder you scream, the more there's somebody there with a nice warm towel and a pair of slippers. Yeah, Justin Haythe, the writer, and I are big fans of the novel and all things sort of H.P. Lovecraft, and we're kind of colliding a lot of that together. It certainly felt like this idea of taking a place that's sort of perched up there above the clouds and has, you know, been watching modern man and this sort of metastasizing disorder and is there to offer a diagnosis. You know, that was sort of the first way in. And what if that, you know, what if that was a form of absolution? What if, you know, you were no longer responsible because you're not well? You have a note from your doctor. And that kind of, then that narcotic or that opiate or that sort of lotus eaters aspect of phase one of this process. I always imagined it'd be a place where if Lockhart, Dane DeHaan's character, kept meandering through the steam room, he might bump into Dick Cheney wrapped in a towel in the back corner. You know, it's like, what type of people are vulnerable to that sort of that diagnosis?
But there's a point in almost all your movies where your protagonist questions if he's sane or not. I mean, we can look at Brad Pitt in The Mexican, or Nathan Lane in Mouse Hunt, or Johnny Depp in Pirates. That happens about halfway into each movie you've made, where the hero is asking if he's sane or not.
Well, yeah. I mean, this one is much different. It's a bolder step into the sort of dream logic. I think that, you know, the movie is really about two worlds, and it's not immediately reducible as a kind of
in conceptual terms. Yes,
conceptual terms, but it definitely, you know, I see it as a sort of modern gothic, because it's you know, we're taking a very modern man, but we're putting him through this place. And as he gets closer, he, you know, his watch stops working and his cell phone doesn't work, and he's sort of slipping out of bounds. I mean, he's entering a more of a dream logic, and, you know, you're watching him reluctantly become a patient at this sanatorium, but really you're the patient, right? I mean, you're in the darkened room, and we're using sound and image and bringing everything to bear to sort of, we have you for a period of time, and we're sort of slow cooking the audience. And that, I mean, the genre allows for that more so than other types of narrative. And so, you know, it's fun to kind of boldly embrace that. I think there are, you know, there's the sort of hand on the back way of telling a story, and there's the breadcrumb way of telling a story. And this is definitely, you know, leading you through a maze with breadcrumbs and using enigmatic concepts and putting things adjacent in the way. Well, you know, the writer Murakami? Yeah. So like that style of narrative, not really a Western narrative per se, but you kind of feel like, yeah, this is accruing somehow, but it's not in the way, it's not in a waking state.
But you talk about Murakami, and the difference between Murakami and Lovecraft, or the Western style, is that we demand control, and the idea of losing control is the most nightmarish thing that could possibly happen to us. And it becomes a point where suddenly reality seems to sort of recede. And that's something you've gone to, again, going through all your movies, is a point where that the idea of not being on solid ground disappears for your protagonist, and that seems to be something that...
Sure, the untrustworthy narrator. I mean, that's you get a lot more agitation, I think, from an audience if you're watching a movie and you're not quite sure if we're willing to go too far. I mean, I think this movie pierces that membrane a couple of places, and I think there's value in letting you know that, you know, you're not sure when we're going to go past a particular point. And then that has to do, you know, Lovecraft has that great sense of, you know, looking into the unknown and sort of trying to understand it is like, that's where you go mad, right?
Sure.
So that boundary of the unknown, and that, I suppose, is that's the wonderful place to be. I mean, I don't know if that comes from music or, you know, music background or whatnot, but, you know, sort of on the brink of, you know, of failure, like the train could go off the rails at any moment. And I think that, you know, that gets you to that place where you might be, look, everybody said, don't make a pirate movie. The data said, you know, you're crazy. And people said, you don't know how to make an animated movie. And, you know, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but the spirit of, and the data says, don't make this movie, right? I mean, you know, you try to get to that place where the more people are saying no, the more pleasure you have in it.
I like that strain and perversity you're showing here so far, but that idea of, we're talking about, you go to Lovecraft, the protagonist is often somebody who thinks he knows what he's looking for.
Sure.
And again,
well, I think that Dane's character Lockhart is very much in denial.
And we should say his character goes and is assigned to go to the sanitarium to retrieve somebody who can help save a business.
Yeah, he's got it in spades. This sort of you know, contemporary human condition. He's a stockbroker who's going to do whatever it takes to get ahead. And it's an interesting thing that trying to put this sense of sickness into the narrative itself, like trying to, the camera moves and the composition and the sound, we would record wheezing breaths and put them into the steam. And yeah, the protagonist who's in denial is making his way to this place, but the movie's not in denial. I mean, the voice of the narrator is summoning him, right? I mean, that little, even though we start in the modern world, that little lullaby and the wax seal on the envelope, and there are cues that are sort of telling you that, you know, this is, we're going to go to this third
and
act.
The water burbling and the water coolant's almost coming from underground, and that water, the water for you is something you go to again and again, isn't it? I mean, it's something that's been prevalent in all the films you've done.
Sure. It's always, in this movie, it's, you know, there are drowning nightmares. You get to share nightmares, and there are nightmares of drowning. It's also a form of purification and contamination
baptism.
And baptism and catharsis and, you know, rebirth, and it's a wonderful and difficult substance to photograph in, but it gives you something that you know you can't quite control.
It's a treat when we're talking to a man who probably won't be doing any Rolex commercials anytime soon. Gore Verbinski, his new film is director, is A Cure for Wellness. But I think I just find myself too thinking about your first film is provisionally a comedy that you shoot in Gothic terms, but in Gothic films, we're used to seeing this generally a sepia tone. There's something that tells us we're looking at the past. And you use an astonishing amount of visual clarity to render Gothic storytelling, which is, I think, something that, that contradicts what we're used to seeing in Gothic films.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think, you know, I guess that comes from a fear of if when curtain closes that you could, you know, categorize or dismiss this thing. And if we can access some contemporary fear, if we can, you know, when 3 or 5 days later, hopefully you're feeling the side effects of taking the cure, you know, that there's something. And that's why, you know, what is it about us that makes us pray to the pharmaceutical industry or to, you know, that kale smoothie or whatever it is? If I said to you, you know, when was the last time you slept well, or, you know, do your feet hurt? At some point you're going to go, yeah, I have that. I have the, you know, itchy elbow or whatever it is. You're going to, and why are we, what is it that makes us, we must, if you back up 2 steps, and I don't know exactly what it is, but we must know that we're not well, or we must be hungry for that diagnosis. So this film is very much trying to, yeah, tap into a little bit of that. And I think a film like The Ring, you know, that came out after 9/11, and that film was very much about the sort of transferable nature of hatred. And I think at that time they're all sort of unspoken, deep subtextual stuff. But, you know, we were, why are people flying airplanes into buildings? What did I do to deserve this? And the movie is very much about a kind of chain letter approach to evil and that sort of transferable nature of that. And I think there was a reason it played for, you know, the second weekend and the third weekend, and kids were kind of, you know, haunted by it. And you could say it's because it's about technology or all that, you know, but that's very surface. I think A Cure for Wellness, you know, hopefully within all of its macabre and gothic tonalities, has something that resonates that's contemporary.
One of the things that you just said that I want to get to is that idea that a state of being is infectious, and that happens in all the movies that you've done, comedy or even in Rango. The idea that this state can be passed from one person to another is the idea of a contagion, and be it benign or whatever, is a theme that runs through your work too, isn't it?
You're on the outside, so you can.
No.
It's hatched, it's up to you.
It's happened a lot in your movies, though.
It might be subliminal.
I'm just the guy who's seen them. I'm just asking
exactly.
You about
it. Okay, sure. Yes, Professor Elvis. Thank you. Yes.
But no, that idea, that goes back to Lovecraft, too, that once you touch something, the idea of contact.
Sure. I mean, it's a membrane, the theater. That's a screen itself, right? I mean, we are, you know, trying to infect or create a contagion, that something that, look, and that's what I mean about this sort of the breadcrumb approach to narrative. If we can, and I think the genre allows for that more so than, you know, I think there's value on that sort of hand on the back storytelling of a film like Rango or something, but if we can get you sort of nibbling, then that little sort of rusty door in your forehead kind of, you know, it sort of opens up, and we have access to your hard drive, right? I mean, we can do a lot more damage if you're kind of squinting and kind of, how does that relate to that? And you start doing the work, you know, like the gears start turning, you let us inside.
I think, though, as we're talking about this, one of the things that this occurred to me in watching was the idea that so often greed is kind of contagion. This mm-hmm. idea of wanting more than you should be able to have, becomes an infection in these movies too.
Sure. I think that there's a real, you know, at the end of this movie, Lockhart and Hannah are sort of leaving both of these worlds behind.
Which is Hannah's a young woman who he finds.
Yeah, she's kind of been, you know, behind the gates of this place for a long time.
Basically raised in it. Well, giving too much away.
Yeah, she's almost a North Korean, you know. I mean, she's developed a worldview from being in one place and one belief system for a very long time. And yeah, and then so he's really being kind of put to sleep, and she's sort of awakening. And I always love the end of The Graduate, you know, where you're kind of like, well, what now?
Yeah, the now what ending, sure.
Yeah, and there's something about, you know, that's why you were talking about the, I don't want to, no spoilers, but, you know, the sort of modern world returning at the very end to kind of remind us that, look, they're rejecting both of these worlds. And I think youth today, whether they're taking a gap year in college or there's a, there's a palpable sense of why the treadmill, like questioning the treadmill. You know, it got us here, but if we were, you know, amoeba growing exponentially in a test tube, the last thing you'd hear us say was like, "Don't worry, it's half empty." Right? And it's like, boom, we can't, you don't see the velocity of, you know, and I think that more and more, you know, our fathers have sort of handed us down this kind of birth, school, work, death, you know, mantra.
And it got us here.
Now there's no more headroom. And I think more and more you have sort of intelligent youth kind of going, time out, you know. Maybe it's the treadmill itself.
Well, but that's that question that so often comes into play in your work as a filmmaker, that the kind of stories you're interested in, the idea of somebody who's compulsively on this treadmill, who basically has tunnel vision on it, who can't see the world around him, taken off of that and doesn't know what to do when he's asked to take a deep breath.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's, you know, it's, like question growth, question, you know, the premise of, you know, infinite growth. You know, at some point you got to go, really? Is that, you know, is that the algorithm was created by man, but we're in service of it now. So, you know, what happens when we just take a moment? I don't know the answers, but, you know, it's certainly worth saying maybe, you know, just take a moment, look at the stars, you know?
Which happens in this movie, by the way. But I guess one of the things I want to say, too, is we're talking about Lovecraft. One of the things that I think really links you as a storyteller, that be it in a comedy or other genres that you tackle, is that you take your time in this. I mean, the first act, in effect, contains almost no information except sort of setting up the premise and then just the hero just kind of wandering into what seems like the right direction and then not really getting there.
Yeah, I think that there's, you know, that just comes from a love of movies of the 70s. I mean, I think that there was, you know, we've sort of distilled, particularly, you know, genre, or we've distilled things down into these 90 minutes of pop-out scares or a sort of infinitely reducible concept on the left side, and on the right side some massive, you know, intellectual property or, you know, something that, you know, that we're very familiar with. You see the eventizing of the theatrical experience.
Well, you've become a big part of that, though, in the last few years.
Guilty as charged. Yeah, absolutely. But you feel the fabric tearing, and you, on the right hand side, you've got, you know, that the familiarity of going to a cinema and saying, I've played the video game, or I went to the theme park, or I know the toy, or read the graphic novel, and so you kind of more and more we're eventizing, and then you see really great writing running to television, you know, to long form. You know, really smart writers are going, I don't know what to do here. With, you know, I can only write so many giant robot movies, and I'm out. You know, and so you see, there's a lot of good reasons to stay at home, and you know, it's a big ask. Get in your car, drive to the theater, pay too much for popcorn, go see a movie, and so the fabric's tearing. And then on the left, you've got the kind of like really, you know, one line pitch, you know. So it's very, it's easier to get $150 million to make a movie or eight than it is to get 38, you know, and so there's no middle at all anymore. And yeah, I feel really lucky that right or wrong, when everybody leaves the room, you kind of go, well, maybe there are opportunities here, you know. It's like, hello. I mean, it's literally nobody is doing this scale for original concept, you know, no huge stars, although I think Dane's on his way there. You know, it's nothing particularly familiar, certainly not something you can kind of pitch in one sentence. But we used to go to the movies and not know, you know? We used to sit down in a movie theater and go, I have no idea what's coming. And all the other stuff, the toys and books and theme parks were all kind of after, right? It was our job to create the intellectual property, not to chase it, you know. So it's an interesting time. And I was very lucky that you know, working with the folks at New Regency and Arnon Milchan in particular, who is kind of the last guy with any sort of intuitive sense of, yeah, I like that, let's do that, you know. There's so much data now that is telling you to not do anything, to not take the risk, to not do anything that is particularly unknowable.
That's a good point to take a break. We're getting philosophical with the director of A Cure for Wellness, Gore Verbinski.
Sorry.
No. That's why you're here.
We'll take it back a notch.
No. We'll continue with these notches. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
I'm now torturing the director of Cure for Wellness, Gore Verbinski. It's the treatment. But I want to get back to this, when I was saying that you treat the first third of your movie as a way to immerse audiences into the environment rather than telegraphing plot or letting them know what the movie's about. I mean, that seems to be, we're talking about intuition, that seems to be your intuition as a filmmaker.
Well, you should watch it again because there are coded messages in that beginning as well. I mean, I think there is...
Oh, basically the train going into the tunnel is the metaphor for the movie.
And you know, if he was like that deer and if he would just lie down, it would all go a lot easier for him. And by the way,
another metaphor, the crash of the old world and the new world, technology and nature.
A lot of portals opening and closing, a lot of boundaries, a lot of mirrors and reflections. And he's right from the beginning, you know, that sort of gothic tune. And I always love this movie called The Innocents.
The adaptation of Henry James. Yeah, absolutely.
Jack Clayton.
Absolutely.
And there's a great tune in that little Weeping Willow song, you know, and it becomes kind of a sonic mortar for all these bricks that are being held together. And so when we were writing, Ben Walfish, the composer, and I were working on this tune that had to seem sort of oddly familiar but also kind of a lullaby but then become a Bavarian waltz by the third act. And that thing is sort of wafting across the Atlantic from someplace. You know, the perfume bottle has been opened and that's making its way to this little corner office and sort of, you know, along with this letter kind of... That's a contagion, and that's moving Morris aside, and the place doesn't care, right? Send up the new meat, right? I mean, elevator, you know, new meat, and we meet our protagonist, and he's got that office with the dead fish floating in the bowl, and is immediately summoned upstairs.
And the vaunted corner view, that's the place where people want to arrive to at the end of the movie, and he's there at the beginning, and it's not home, or it's not
exactly.
It's not the be-all, end-all.
Yeah, there's something very Kurtz about that letter, you know, that it's, I think, even as in denial as he is, it's speaking to
his
soul.
You say he gets a letter that summons him to this place.
Yeah, it's sort of... it's a very...
And it's a letter that comes from the past almost, again, with that wax seal on it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when, you know, as soon as Morris touches it, he's, you know, I mean...
He's infected.
He's it's over for him. But I think that it does speak, you know, it's Pembroke, who is the CEO, has written this kind of thesis on what's wrong with modern man, and it is sort of a letter of resignation of a merger.
And people tell him he's crazy for having what seem like pretty clear thoughts about...
Yeah, he's had his epiphany up there in the Alps, and he's not coming back. And I think, you know, when Lockhart's reading it on the train, he's certainly... It's not the first time he's read that letter. There's a reason he keeps pulling it out and reading it, you know. So I think, the movies like Polanski's... The Tenant, and even Don't Look Now or The Servant by Joseph Losey, certainly The Shining. All those movies have a real sense of something inevitable, like a hidden force, right? It's pulling the camera down the corridor. It's pulling the protagonist towards his epiphany. And, you know, we're sort of likening that to a black spot on your X-ray or to disease or some sense of, something inevitable is accruing and occurring. And so you have to... take a little time to feel that, you know, and it's the voice of the movie itself. It'd be interesting to see, to have you watch it again now, knowing where it ends up, and look for those
Those signposts. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly there, but the movie takes its time.
It's not like a bank heist and, you know, it's not like bank heist, infidelity, you know, two brothers on an island, go. You know, it's not, it doesn't, you know what I mean? It's like buried treasure from, you know, brother gets out of jail. I mean, I'm just like vamp, but, you know, you can like, there are, you know, there are good standardized plots that can function well, but we're sort of drifting into a dream logic with this place.
But you've done that so often. Again, even Rango sort of does that, where it feels distended because there is no arrival. I mean, again, you go back and look at the movies, there are certainly all these indicators, these signifiers, in fact, that offer not only clues to the plot, but also clues as to the state of the movie, in fact. But in storytelling terms, you're not rushing anything.
Sure. But it's a slow cooking operation. I mean, it's not, you know, I am, you know, not in the offend no one business, right? I mean, it's I like an Egg McMuffin as much as the next person, but I don't want to make one, right? We're cooking up a goat's head soup with some curry, and it's for the more adventurous eater, you know. And I think that's really, you know, what's wonderful about trying to do something in the moderate-sized movie in the middle is it doesn't have to be for everybody, right? It just has to find its champions or its kind of core audience, and then we can survive.
My guess who just evoked a Rolling Stones album cover, and the movie actually feels like that, is Gore Verbinski. His new film as director is A Cure for Wellness. It's The Treatment. But one of the things you do, too, is that in these genres that you've worked in, you haven't used any of the machinery that we're used to, the POV camera, the sort of trying to create dread with expected effects. And you said something in the first half that makes me think you're almost intuitively, instinctively a contrarian.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it like that. But I just think that there is, I don't know. I'm a product of probably, you know, reading Kafka when I was too young, you know, sneaking in to see The Exorcist, you know, early Black Sabbath records, you know. Yeah, that's probably all kind of had – I mean, look, if I was going to make a giraffe with an alligator's head, I'd have to have seen a giraffe and an alligator, right? I mean, you know, there's a lot in there. I don't think about it from the outside so much. You know, I never think about – career choices. It's more.
So these,
what is the movie? What is a movie you have to? What is the story you have to tell? And if you can't answer that question, why do you have to tell this story? You're going to be 40 days into a 100-day film shoot, and your crew's going to lynch you. I mean, you know, you can't lead people through the jungle if you don't have a real sense of every day you're waking up and you're like, there's a reason. I can feel my hands, you know, through all the jelly, and I'm holding the steering wheel. You know, it's not slipping out of my hands.
I guess what I'm trying to ask you here is that you're out to change, like, the state of the audience, and that what dreams do and movies do, where if you take your time more, that builds up more of a sense of anticipation and more of a sense of dread and more of a sense of tension than if you rush these things, which we've now come to expect in movies, be it comedy or suspense films or action or whatever. We're used to seeing things right away that are telling us what we're going to be seeing. And you spend the first 4 minutes of a movie with a character who we're never going to see again.
Is that a problem?
I'm really asking questions. I'm trying to seek fullness of detail here, Gore. Yeah. I'm not making any kind of judgment about this.
No, it's a healthy observation. I feel like, is there a couch? I mean,
is your back bothering you? I need to get you something.
No, just like the psychoanalysis can continue.
I'm just asking questions because it's a really compelling body of work that, again, going back to Mouse Hunt, it's staged to look like a horror movie. It could be The Innocents, in fact.
I think that I love a movie that is told by one person's point of view, like sitting around a fire and one person's telling you a story. And it's not been homogenized or been put through some process where it's okay that it's bumpy or flawed. I love the flawed narrative. I it's delicious to me. So, I was wrong. And I thought when I, you know, Mouse Hunt was my first movie, and I thought I was making a movie about two brothers and the string metaphor, you know, sort of. It's like, no, you're making a mouse movie, you know. But I wouldn't have made the same movie if I hadn't been wrong, you know, in terms of, like, a passionate approach to, like, this is the story I'm telling, you know. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does.
You know, you have to kind of find an angle.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm saying is you use unconventional angles to tell stories and genres. I mean, if you just to describe Mouse Hunt to somebody, you expect to see like an overlighted comedy where you'd see everything in the room all the time.
It was like 40 minutes of that movie on the editing room floor, like immediately, like as soon as I showed it to the studio.
They're like,
okay, get rid of all that. Don't need that. Let's just cut that out. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I guess it's called Mouse Hunt. What was I thinking? Yeah, I mean, there was some great Lee Evans stuff and Nathan Lane stuff that was just never, you know, too far away. We're too long away from the protagonist, which is the mouse. I'm like, oh, God. But, yeah, these are all opportunities to learn, right? I mean, that's the core of it, right? It's like getting to that place where I don't know, you know? As soon as the scariest moment in my career was when Dick Cook and the folks at Disney on Pirates 2 and 3 started to say, you know, just keep doing that thing you're doing, right? And like on the first movie, they were scared. There was like endless meetings of like, we have a problem, we're worried. First of all, it's a pirate movie. Secondly, what the hell is Johnny Depp doing? And is he drunk? What is, you know, and all the questions, and you got to get rid of his gold teeth. And oh my God, he looked, and you know, just fear coming at you from all these areas. And as soon as that fear goes away, you're like, uh-oh, right? Because you're like, wait, everybody, these are knowns now. I mean, actors are showing up going, I know, I saw, you know, I was in the first movie and they love it when I do this or whatever. You know, I mean, everything is a known. And you're like, the only reason it was exciting or it worked was because we didn't know. So, you see that kind of pushing and certainly that, you know, the Davy Jones locker sequence in the third one that gets quite sort of surreal is, you know, these are sort of, I get desperate attempts to kind of let's get to that boundary of the unknown again.
Again, what I said in the first half, I think you're a contrarian and you push against, some part of you is always pushing against what expectations are supposed to be. And I wonder if maybe that even comes from shooting music video where you're trying to find a way to tell a story and not just illustrate the lyrics.
Sure. Well, music in general. I mean, I'm really a failed musician. That's, you know, this is sort of the backup plan, right? I mean, I went to film school, but I was also playing in a lot of bands in Hollywood, you know, at the time. And I get to work with musicians who are 100 times better than I ever was. You know, I get to work with writers who are better than I am. I get to work with cameramen and actors, and you know. But I have a love for all of these things. A love for storytelling, and yeah, there is something about punk rock that there's something that and that there's. It's very, you know. Yeah, Sid Vicious was a pirate, right? I mean, you know, there are
Stiff Bates was a pirate.
Stiff. love Stiff. Yeah, bless him. Yeah, I think that, you know, I suppose there's something about the belief that audiences in their heart of hearts want to see something new. We have a system that is, you know, corroborating and collecting data based on last year's trend, right? So it's inevitable that it's going to copy or try to get as close to whatever worked. And the more you do that, the less you're sort of tinkering and the less something new is going to, you know, that's why they love sequels, right? I mean, it's like it's data. You know, we have information on this. But it's harder and harder to get to that place of, you know, something that occurred, something that sort of blew up in your face. And yeah, I think there's a spirit to that music that was about that as well.
Yeah.
Not just tearing it down. You know, it's very easy to just tear it down. That's not the point. It's more to learn, to question.
But also in punk, and I think this gets lost, especially for generations now, there's a real sense of showmanship in that. And I think of you as much as anything else as a showman and almost as some old-fashioned tradition.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think next to kind of, you know, I mean, the big enemy is mediocrity, right? I mean, that's, you know, it's it's like scratching at your heels every day. And if you take a breath, it's like a big valley. It's like the inverted kind of bell curve. I mean, you're gonna end up there. You know, there's just no doubt you're gonna end up there. Whether you're blaming it on a studio or you're just, you know, lazy or not inventive enough. So you're like scratching and clawing and fighting and throwing that kind of pick against the ice and sort of making your way up the slippery slope, that it's looming.
But this is a thing that happens in movie theaters and when you go see a show at a club, moment of expectation when the lights are going down in both places, what am I going to get?
I mean, that's a great way to go see a movie, I think, is like to not know. We know so much about the experience prior to engaging in it these days. And I think my favorite film last year was this movie called The Lobster. Did you ever see it? You know,
we had Colin Farrell come on and talk about it, yeah.
Nobody told me anything about that movie other than somebody said, oh, you should check this out. And I caught it, I think on Netflix or something. I mean, I'd never even heard of it, you know, and I was just overjoyed that it got made. And yeah, they're out there. People are doing it. You know, I think it's, you know, the spirit's alive.
But this gets back to this idea of putting on a show. And part of putting on a show is getting the audience to forget where they are and to lean in a little bit. And that's this idea of contradicting expectations maybe comes from that a little bit too, do you think?
I mean, I think that, the second, you know, next to mediocrity is boredom, right? I mean, that's, you know, those are the two evils, right? You want to, you know, it's the entertainment industry. You want to be entertaining. I think.
But we're talking about so much of entertainment nowadays is based on you telling people they're going to see, they see what they just see in the trailer, and then they go home and watch it again so they can repeat the experience that they were told they're going to get before they walk into the movie theater.
Sure, but we're forgetting that the potential of cinema is the casting of spells, right? I mean, that's really the kind of, you know, that's our job, right? To kind of, it's a form of hypnosis. So we are spellcasters, and if you hesitate, they're there with sharpened knives, you know. But there's something nice about kind of slowly casting a spell over an audience and taking them through a narrative.
And with that incantation, we're out of time. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Gore. Thank you.
It's really nice to hang out.
My pleasure. My guest is Gore Verbinski, whose new incantation is A Cure for Wellness. Again, what a great title. Our recording engineer, who also mixes the show, is Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell, and it's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.